Good morning and welcome to Jewish Faith and Jewish Facts. I'm Rabbi Stephen Garten speaking to you from Ottawa, Canada. This week, the Jewish world begins a new book of the Torah. The third book, known in English as Leviticus and in Hebrew Vayikra, is begun in a weekly cycle. And the Torah portion for this week is, in fact, called Vayikra, taking its name from the very beginning of the parasha, verse 1. Let me offer an overview of the parasha before I introduce my guest, who will help us unpack this unusual but interesting parasha. This week, beginning in Leviticus 1:1, God calls to Moses from the tent of meeting and communicates with him the laws of the korbanot, the animal and meal offerings to be brought in the sanctuary, the tabernacle, the construction of which we read about in the previous 4 weeks. Here are the sacrifices that are enumerated in this week's parasha. The ascending offering, the olah, that is wholly raised to God by fire atop the altar. 5 varieties of meal offerings, known in Hebrew as mincha, prepared with fine flour, olive oil, and frankincense. The peace offering, the shlemim, whose meat was eaten by the one bringing the offering, after parts are burned on the altar and parts are given to the Kohanim, the priests. The different types of sin offering, known in Hebrew as chatat, brought to atone for transgressions committed erroneously by the high priest, the entire community, the king, or even the ordinary member of Israel. The guilt offering, the asham, brought by one who has misappropriated property of the sanctuary, who is in doubt as to whether he transgressed a divine prohibition as enumerated in the Torah, or who has committed a betrayal against God by swearing falsely to defraud a fellow human being. The Torah portion is the beginning of what will be Israelite religion, the sacrificial cult. And with me this morning is certainly someone who is well qualified to help us understand this week's parasha. Rabbi Paul Gollum is the senior scholar and rabbi emeritus of the Vassar Temple in Poughkeepsie, New York. After serving as their congregational rabbi for 15 years, he is a graduate of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of New York, and he has been a director at Hillel Foundations and was for a time being the regional director for the Union of Reform Judaism in Canada. Rabbi Gollum has taught undergraduate and graduate courses in philosophy, classical and modern Jewish thought. He has served as the editor-in-chief of the CCA Journal, a Reform Jewish quarterly, and has published articles on biblical studies, modern Jewish thought, interfaith relations, and Reform Zionism. He represents the American Association of Reform Zionists on the board and cabinet of the American Zionist Movement, and is at times on the North American Board of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. It is with a great deal of joy that I welcome back to our program, Rabbi Paul Gollum. Good morning.
Good morning to you too.
As I said, it's a pleasure to have you back, and you are precisely the right person to help us understand this unusual Torah portion. We're so used to the book of Exodus, which for the majority of the book is a book of narrative, of big, exciting stories with great special effects, the splitting of the Red Sea and the revelation at Sinai and the manna that comes down from heaven and the quails. Even the golden calf certainly could be filmed as it has been with great special effects. And now we begin something which appears to be fairly pedestrian.
Yeah.
So help us understand, what is it about this book in particular? And of course, why is this the perfect introductory portion for the book of Leviticus?
Yeah, that's a very useful question. I mean, you're familiar with the old joke that in Genesis, everything begins. In Exodus, two big things happen. In Leviticus, nothing happens. And in Numbers, who knows what happens? And in Deuteronomy, it happens all over again. So the tradition is that Leviticus is a book about nothing, in the sense that there doesn't seem to be any narrative that propels it. My own sense was, well, this is the book you want to avoid, and it's of course the danger spot for anybody who's going to celebrate a bar mitzvah in the spring, because they're stuck with this book as the Torah portion. So, from an adult point of view, it's a much, much richer section than is normally recognized. For the first thing to note is that usually when we think about Torah, when we think about God interacting with Moses, the conventional image that comes to our minds is that Moses is standing at the top of Mount Sinai. This first verse, as you have already indicated, tells us that's not where Moses is. Moses is in a tent right in the middle of the Israelites. That the interaction between God and Moses is not taking place, you know, in some high place, actually separated from the rest of the people, and we were familiar with the Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille sound and special effects, the thunder and the lightning, everything that could be happening at the top of that mountain, which is extraordinarily dramatic. Here we're given an image of Moses sitting down like at a desk, pen in hand, and taking notes as God essentially dictates to him.
It's interesting that you want to begin there, because last week in the final portion of Exodus, we're told that the Spirit of God filled the tent of meeting, and there was no room for Moses.
Yes.
In the tent of meeting. And now we begin the new book, and Moses and God are in cahoots, as you suggested. Yeah. Moses is at his desk, since we're in the pre-computer age, it's not being transcribed simultaneously. He's got to write it.
Yes.
So how do we make this transition? Why is this important? Is it just a continuation of the importance Torah places on meaningless detail?
Well, there is a numbing amount of detail, and you've already given an indication. This is just the first of the 11 Torah portions that you have in this book, and in most of the book. There are only two narratives, two very, very brief narratives in the entire book. Most of it is like what you already have described. But what I would focus on is, again, precisely this location. This is where the rubber is meeting the road. This is where we're going to begin the process of figuring out how to organize the people Israel so that they can have a relationship with each other and that they can have a fruitful relationship with God. Now, you can see this perhaps in the context that for generations and generations, they had no relationship with God. Until they finally called out after many generations of servitude. Their God was the Pharaoh. And now they need to reestablish a relationship with the Eternal, the creator of heaven and earth, the one who is the source of all being. That in and of itself is sort of problematic. How does a human being do that?
Well, even if I could interrupt, even more challenging, because in Genesis, we see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their wives have some sort of relationship with God.
Yeah.
And we have narratives about their relationship, but now it's a corporate relationship.
Yes. Right. And that requires then some form of structure. So the end of the book of Exodus gives us literally the structure, this tabernacle, this movable sanctuary that they can carry through the wilderness and then finally establish when they get to the land. But the structure in and of itself can't be a fetish or an idol. It has to be a place in which something happens. And so what happens there? Well, you've described it, what is going to happen there is cultic activity, the sacrifices. But the heart of the sacrifices is the notion of reconciliation. Again, what do you do if you've wronged someone? What do you do if you've wronged God? What if you do if you've wronged the community? What do you do if you've wronged yourself? How do you get out of that? And what is noted is that words are cheap. Okay, I can say I'm sorry. That might not count for all that much, especially if the action I did was so egregious that a mere sorry doesn't seem to work. One's going to have to do more. And what's really important is not merely that one has to do more, and we use here the term sacrifice, a really useful term. I'm going to give up something I consider personally dear. But it's not merely the sacrifice that's being done, but it's the willingness on the part of the community now to accept that, to say, this will suffice, we can now move forward. And that is what is so central here. And I think that it is done in all of these numbing details, precisely so that one can feel that they're, on the one hand, that they're doing it right. And even more important is the community that might have felt wronged by that individual can see that something substantial and sincere and representing the favor of God is being done. If God can show favor, and we're told over and over again that that which is laid upon the altar will be a pleasing smell to God, that if it can show, if God can treat this with favor, then certainly we can as well. This is a powerful first step in the whole notion of reconciliation.
It's an interesting word to use because it's not a word that the text really uses, reconciliation, but your interpretation of reconciliation fits nicely with this Hebrew of korbanot. So korbanot, which is the Hebrew used in the text for sacrifices, has the root of coming closer.
Yes.
And so reconciliation is certainly the coming closer to those who you have in some way injured.
Right.
And you want to make expiation for your behavior. And doing that requires you to come closer to that person.
Yes.
And I guess it has that dual nature, as you've suggested, that you come closer to God and you come closer to those who you have done ill to.
Right. And we should add that there is one other type of sacrifice that has been mentioned here and that you mentioned it, that you refer to it as the peace offering. It's this is not an offering that is given because there has been disruption, and therefore now there's peace. It's not a matter of war and peace, but it is a matter of well-being. It's a sacrifice, I would suggest, of humility. It's this notion that when good things happen, when we have a reason to be satisfied and cheerful because of some wonderful events, that we recognize that the nature of those events also includes God's goodwill. That part of our celebration is also to include God, to acknowledge the source of all celebration. And we have that as well. So we look at the sacrifice not merely from the point of view of guilt, but also from the point of view of the totality of our lives.
Rabbi Golem, for most of your career, you've served liberal congregations or worked in organizations that represented the movement of the American Reform Movement. And even in your Zionist activity, you represented the Reform Zionist activity. The commentary known as the Plaut Commentary, Rabbi Gunther Plaut of Holy Blossom Temple in Toronto, Canada, wrote the seminal modern English, or the first English commentary on the Torah, in the mid-1970s. And in that book, Rabbi Bamberger, who wrote the commentary on the book of Leviticus, indicates that he thinks that this should be seen as a wonderful historical record of the behaviors of the Israelites, suggesting that other than historical purposes, there might not be any real meaning to the book of Leviticus for the modern reader. You've suggested a number of ways of interpreting the book, which seem to me to be at odds with that historical approach. Not that we should be ahistorical, but you seem to suggest that we can find spiritual meaning. Am I reading you correctly?
Yes, I think so. And I appreciate you bringing that up. That there is sometimes an advantage to contextualization, especially when you come across, for the lack of a better term, non-felicitous phrases. You know, the things that you'll read in scripture that just seem to be absolutely at odds with modern sensibility. So one way you can handle it is, we'll contextualize it. That this is a text from 2,500, 3,000 years ago. A different society, a different culture, a different mindset. You can do that. I tend to like to think about the scripture as being eternal. And attempting to understand it exactly in a deeper fashion, I'm going to give you one quick example, which is really not from this Torah portion, but is really very famous. And that's what is conventionally referred to, or at least by scholars, as lex talionis, the idea of the eye for an eye. You know, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, so forth. It's three times to be found in the texts of the first five books. And needless to say that if we truly followed it, we'd probably be a blind, toothless society. The classic sages, the Talmudic rabbis, recognized that, and they suggested that the best way to read it is not literally that if I knock your tooth out, you knock my tooth out, but rather to say that you need to do a monetary compensation. But in doing so, they did it in a fraught fashion because they realized that, for instance, with respect to an eye, that if I did something that caused you to lose your sight in one of your eyes, no amount of money can make up for it. Though we might agree that that's the best way to do it. It's the civil way to do it. It's the only way to do it without increasing violence. we still have to read the text seriously as to make us avoid doing something that would actually make you lose your eye in the first place, that it's irreplaceable, that nothing can take place for that. And that's exactly what the text is telling us. Even if it's not giving us a piece of practical information, we don't do sacrifices anymore. We don't have a priesthood. We don't have a temple. But that doesn't mean that we don't take what's going on here with all due seriousness and see what's truly underpinning all of this and why it's underpinning it and why it was important to do this precisely as sacrifice and not as some other form of ritual.
Which may not have even existed at the time the text was written. So what the text is suggesting is that in its context, this is the best methodology for achieving divine aims. If divine aim is reconciliation, if divine aim is coming closer to God, if divine intentionality is to make people understand the role and purpose of the divine in daily life, sacrifices were the best methodology available. Am I reading you correctly?
Yes, absolutely. And notice that what they do, they're public. It's not a private transaction. It's something that recognizes that if I personally hurt you personally, the result is not just simply between me and you. It is between me and you and a much larger community. Your injury has an impact on many, many other people. And therefore, something has to be done that is not merely a private transaction. It needs something more.
This week, when we read the Torah portion, due to the unusual nature of the Hebrew calendar, we're reading it on Saturday. And on Saturday evening, we will begin the Jewish festival of Purim. Purim is the festival that commemorates the story of the Book of Esther, a story, whether we believe it to be fictional or a story that is a reflection of a true events about life of the Jews in Persia under the king known as Ahasuerus. But this Shabbat is known as Shabbat Zachor, the Shabbat before. And though we only have a few minutes left, I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand what is the purpose of Shabbat Zachor, the Shabbat of remembrance?
Right. Yeah, thank you for bringing this in because it fits with the theme that we've already talked about. What we do on this particular Shabbat is we read from the first part of Leviticus, and then we append to it a paragraph that comes just a few verses from chapter 25 of Deuteronomy. I'm just going to read them out quite quickly. Remember, and that's Zachor, remember what Amalek did to you on your journey when you left Egypt, how undeterred by fear of God, he surprised you on the march when you were famished and weary and cut down all the stragglers in your rear. Therefore, when the Eternal, your God, grants you safety from all your enemies around you in the land that the Eternal, your God, is giving you as a hereditary portion, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under the heaven. Do not forget. We are commanded here to remember to forget Amalek. Really, it's a wonderful introduction to Purim, which is, of course, a zany holiday filled with reverses and jokes and everything else. This is, how do you go about remembering to forget? But the key here is exactly this notion. When do you forget Amalek? When you are safe in your land and protected from all the enemies about you. When your enemies have been essentially dissipated or sent so far away that they no longer represent a threat to you in any fashion. What do you do at that point? You literally forget your enemies.
It's an eternal challenge to the Jewish people as we sit here speaking in the midst of a six-month battle between enemies of the Jewish people who attacked from the rear, if one could use that metaphor.
Absolutely.
And the Jewish people certainly will be making the connection between the events of October 7th, 2023, and the holiday of Purim this year, and trying to decide how we can remember to forget.
Yes.
Is that humanly possible?
Well, yes, that's the key, but that's also the key to reconciliations. At some point, the hostilities will be over. At some point in the end of the hostilities, there's going to have to then be a process. And believe me, it's going to be a long, slow process. I only hope that my grandchildren will live to see the events. But when it happens, you no longer say, oh, remember.
You move forward.
You no longer do that. Yes, you have to move forward at that point. You have to blot it from your mind.
And there are certainly examples of Jewish history in which at one point we said, remember, and then we had a sense of reconciliation and moved forward. I'm sure you're old enough to remember when Jewish people never bought products from Germany or Italy or Japan in response to the events of the Second World War. And now, of course, reconciliation has taken place. And while the events are not forgotten, we do not remember it in the same way.
Absolutely.
My guest this morning has been Rabbi Paul Gollum, senior scholar and rabbi emeritus of the Vassar Congregation, Poughkeepsie, New York. I want to thank him for helping us begin our exploration of the Book of Leviticus. You can hear our conversation on CHRI 99.1, or you can listen to it as a podcast on chri.ca website, or you can download it wherever you find your favorite podcasts. For Jewish Faith and Jewish Facts, I'm Rabbi Stephen Garten, wishing you shalom and a good day.